by the Italy ports this year. Rome has been stopping many NGO-run ships from docking in the country, on one occasion sparking a diplomatic rift with France after an NGO-run vessel flying the French flag was denied entry. Italy's policies on the migrant issue have been strongly condemned over the years. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal authorizes Italy and the EU to help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced. That deal today is still in place. Max Civilli, Rome.
Brazil is less than a week away from Lula da Silva's return to the presidency, and preparations are underway for a massive festival in Brasilia, which will be held alongside the official events. Tens of thousands of members of social movements and Lula supporters from around the country are preparing to travel to the capital, many of whom will be camping out to celebrate the new government at the Festival of the Future, for which dozens of Brazilian artists have confirmed their performances. There is both a sense of excitement and tension as protests against the incoming government by supporters of outgoing Jair Bolsonaro are expected. Despite multiple thwarted plots, called terror plots by the incoming government, people are determined to make their way to Brasilia.
I'm going to Brasilia from Sao Paulo to be there for the inauguration of our President Lula, who will be there, which is very satisfying and makes me proud. And I'm also looking forward to participating in the celebrations and festivities of the social movement.
I'm heading to the inauguration of our President Lula. I want to be with him at the festivities, singing and supporting him because there are so many good things to happen in our country.
The presidential transition is advancing, and President-elect Lula has been making known some of his ministerial appointments. Among the most notable are singer, songwriter, and actress Margareth Menezes, who will take on the role of Minister of Culture, and lawyer and writer Silvio Almeida, who serve as Minister of Human Rights. Lula's former environmental minister, Marina Silva, will take another turn heading the ministry. Sources close to Jair Bolsonaro say that he will not be handing off the presidential sash to Lula da Silva and will be taking an extended holiday at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in the United States. Camila Escalante, Sao Paulo.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year with additional afflictions in its trail. Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, a caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms.
As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which are never really talked about. Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the Prime Ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and the prime minister just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty.
But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions.
On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Sai Purza, London.
Fuel prices have slightly dropped in Yemen after the release of two Yemeni fuel ships that were detained by the Saudi-led coalition earlier this week in the Red Sea. The Yemeni army issued a stern warning to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that if the ships were not released soon, military action would follow. Yemeni bus and motorbike drivers in the capital Sana'a, who make a living from public transportation, welcomed the lowering of fuel prices. They say this is going to help them cope with the fuel price hike caused by the blockade.
As you can see, I am pumping 1 liter for only 500 Yemeni riyals, whereas before it used to cost us 1,500 to 2,000 for 1 liter.
The Saudi-led coalition who are seizing Yemeni fuel ships do not respond to peaceful dialogue. They only respond to us when we decide to use our military power, and if that's the case, so be it.
Yemeni political expert says the release of the fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition isn't enough, as Yemen will continue to struggle until Saudi Arabia and its allies completely lift the blockade and end their illegal involvement in Yemen.
Although the price of fuel has slightly dropped, we still need to look at the more pressing issue, and that is the fact that the Saudi-led coalition is still occupying Yemen. We need to reach an ultimate solution that can only come through taking decisive military actions against them. This is the only solution.
Despite falling oil prices, tensions are rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen for what could soon be a resumption of war if a political solution is not reached soon. This as Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue their militarization of strategic Yemeni islands in the Red and Arabian Sea.
The release of Yemeni fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition marks a big victory for the Yemeni government based in Sana'a and to the people living in the areas controlled by Ansar Allah. This also indicates that Saudi Arabia and the UAE simply cannot afford to have their oil industry targeted by Yemeni ballistic missiles, which is why they chose a safer option by releasing the fuel vessels. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
In the limelight.
Experts in the U.S. have warned that they are deeply concerned that the Biden administration is minimizing COVID at a time when it needs to be redoubling its efforts to ensure funding and resources to prevent another surge. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, refuting President Joe Biden's recent claim that the pandemic is over, a group of physicians, epidemiologists, and other experts warned in an open letter published recently that COVID-19 remains a deadly and disabling threat, including in the United States of America, which is ill-prepared for a possible winter surge fueled by the emergence of new Omicron strains. We know from our clinical and research experience that the pandemic is far from over. and that national efforts to secure the health and well-being of the American public are far from complete, the scholars wrote in the esteemed British Medical Journal, adding, "We're deeply concerned that the Biden administration is minimizing COVID at a time when it needs to be redoubling its efforts to ensure funding and resources to prevent another surge. The U.S. hasn't put in the effort needed to move into a new phase with confidence," states the letter, adding, "Booster coverage even among older Americans is abysmal. With only half of vaccinated adults having received a booster, this places the U.S. 73rd globally for booster coverage. Fewer than 6% of immunocompromised Americans, a group that accounted for nearly 1 in 5 hospital admissions during the BA2 surge, have received Evolshot, a therapy to help prevent COVID-19. To make matters worse, just 4% of eligible Americans have so far received the new bivalent booster tailored to protect against the dominant subvariant. Recent polling found that over half of fully vaccinated adults don't know they're eligible for the shot, and less than 1/3 say they plan to get their fourth vaccine dose as soon as possible. Rampant right-wing anti-science campaigns have played a significant role, to be sure, but so too has the nation's for-profit healthcare model, as well as efforts to normalize the ongoing dangers posed by the continuously mutating coronavirus. Soon after Biden downplayed the pandemic in his 60 Minutes interview, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, announced that masking will no longer be universally required in healthcare facilities and nursing homes. If Biden's recent comment indicates that the administration is positioned to pull back further pandemic mitigation, the public health experts warned recently, the U.S. will be preparing for a major storm without even an umbrella in hand. They wrote, "Pandemics do not end with a flip of a switch," adding, "Despite the widespread belief that the pandemic is over, death and disruption continue. As Americans embrace what McKinsey and Company has called individual endemicity, in which people let their risk tolerance dictate the preventive measures they take, transmission rates remain at dangerous levels in nearly every county of the U.S. throughout the summer. The U.S. recorded approximately 3,000 deaths per week, at least the equivalent of a 9/11's worth of deaths each week, and often more. The Delta and Omicron surges took 350,000 American lives in 7 months, almost 7 times as many fatalities as claimed by the most severe flu season in years. In early September 2022, COVID-19 was the second leading cause of death in the United States, claiming more lives than stroke and common cancers." Beyond its outsized death toll, COVID-19 is leaving many Americans in diminished health and with less economic security. More than 7% of Americans report experiencing protracted post-COVID symptoms. Recent estimates suggest long COVID has forced at least 500,000 people out of the workplace. The continuing impact of the pandemic is particularly devastating given its unequal burden on communities of color and socioeconomically vulnerable populations, who are less likely to have private insurance to cover prevention, testing, and treatment costs. The U.S. is in a different position than it was when the pandemic first emerged, thanks to the increased availability of vaccines, tests, and treatments made possible by robust funding. But the money underpinning the free provision of those medical tools is rapidly disappearing, leading to what Adam Gaffney, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard University and pulmonary and intensive care unit doctor, calls the rationing of COVID care by ability to pay. While Biden has repeatedly asked Congress to authorize billions of dollars in additional spending to address COVID-19 and monkeypox, including resources that would be directed toward international efforts, lawmakers led by Senator and the Republicans have refused for months to allocate new money. The president's premature assertion about the end of the pandemic, meanwhile, has only bolstered right-wing demands for austerity, and the continuing resolution passed recently excluded funding for both infectious disease outbreaks. Earlier this year, the White House sounded the alarm about the potential coronavirus surge in the coming month that could infect up to 100 million people nationwide, resulting in a million hospitalizations and nearly 200,000 additional deaths in a worst-case scenario. People in the U.S., already home to more than 1 million of the world's COVID-19 deaths, have died at a significantly higher rate than their counterparts in other wealthy nations. For individual health care, paid sick leave, and other life-saving rights for 1 decade ago. Notably, average life expectancy in the U.S. has declined substantially over the past 2 years. The experts wrote, "We need a full court press this fall to reverse these trends and reach more of the public with boosters and antivirals." Echoing recommendations made recently by the People's CDC, the letter continues, "The U.S. must make smart investments in the future of our country's response. We need to continue prioritizing tests, masks, treatments, and ventilation. Failing to produce these resources and make them widely accessible will effectively waste the benefits of the scientific advances we have made thus far. Inadequate funding may also slow or stop our progress towards developing new and more protective nasal and pan-coronavirus vaccines and therapies." Globally, the pandemic has caused more than 15 million deaths. People in low-income countries have been deprived of equal access to life-saving COVID-19 medical tools, leaving billions of people in Africa and other parts of the global south completely unprotected. The Lancet's COVID-19 Commission declared last month that widespread failures during the COVID-19 pandemic at multiple levels worldwide have led to millions of preventable deaths and a reversal in progress towards sustainable development for many countries. Starkly unequal access to medicines, fueled by high-income nations, gobbling up a disproportionate shares of jobs and therapeutics, and pharmaceutical corporations refusing to share knowledge and technology has contributed massively to avoidable suffering. It also enables the coronavirus to continue circulating and mutating, increasing the likelihood of a vaccine-resistant variant emerging. Lancet, in its recent publication about infectious diseases, wrote, "The best chance to stop this pandemic is to make vaccines available for everyone and everywhere. The efforts to provide booster doses should be balanced with the efforts to attain vaccine equity." Special live coverage for the start of New Year 2023 on Saturday, December 31st at 7:30 p.m. Tehran time, 1600 GMT.
Miss Monlay.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has been accused of a cover-up during the time that they were involved in the Afghanistan war. A new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Farhiz, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SAS soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice. The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. As you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down, people who were unarmed, including
Why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered and then, you know, perhaps, again, with, as you said, not in prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda, and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January, right. 1972. And the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces. A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the... first, the general, overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed. And then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed. Because that needs to be... unfortunately or fortunately, reviewed here so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops... then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SAS soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, the UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. They also, there is... discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country, it's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous. And so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of, or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or it's being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But, Frau Hughes, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where... It is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m., you have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home, a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old who were staying there overnight were taken. And a witness said, when I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere. Is that what SAS soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically these special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information, and they're trained to terrorize the local population. You don't have to go any further than was it Abu Ghraib, when you see what happened in the prison with the torture, with prisoners. That were naked, that were attacked by dogs. The dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of like Western imperialism. So, the brutality, there'll be nobody held to account. And these people will just basically get away with murder, and the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascist lure. It's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held the account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Fantina, and you said that this may be, or that this is how orders are, have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation, like over 100 years. And throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look at what the British did in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians and have been for decades now. Violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane, and these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes, but countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Farah Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. I mean, when you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and they're basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue it in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually brought into, or is bringing onto the statute books, a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge. And Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British armed forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Frentino, where it's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defence that created what was called the and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with the stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims received no closure, there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability, and this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for our Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the ruling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for the for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when we take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had U.S. soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they've used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son, it's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable, and in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR. It's all propaganda. It's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And, you know, from the day and hour, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, People will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where, Robert Fintina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court of The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. So when this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
it's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will, and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched is in early next year will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings maybe determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead, held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back as our guest there was talking, Fra Hughes, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former US President George Bush Jr. who have walked scot-free and they've been responsible for so many deaths. And still the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, in my mind, is a war criminal, and so is Bush. And all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there's still landmines. There are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the children.